This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Better Call Paul is a production of Lola Media. Say hi, Lola.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Sarker from Better Call Paul. Just wanted to remind you that the show is intended for entertainment purposes only and is not legal advice. I am not your lawyer unless we separately agree for me to represent you, and the views expressed by Mesh and me are solely our own. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Better Call Paul, the show where we discuss the legal and business side behind the scenes of Hollywood sports and entertainment. I'm your co-host, Paul Sarker, former Marvel lawyer and current Big Law Media attorney.
And I'm your other co-host, Mesh Lakhani. Hey everyone, like, happy Thanksgiving week, my favorite week of the year. I'm very excited for this week, Paul.
Yeah, hey everyone, happy Thanksgiving, or early Thanksgiving, I guess. It's a great week. I like it a lot. Unfortunately, work tends to get really busy for year end, and so this is kind of like in the middle of the sprint, but it is nice to be able to spend time with family and, you know, chill out for a couple days. So we wanted to come up with some favorite Thanksgiving movies and TV shows. I had a hard time coming up with any Thanksgiving movies. I know there's Thanksgiving episodes of TV shows, like The Simpsons and Friends, but I don't know.
Well, I think it's one of those things where we think there's a bunch of Thanksgiving stuff, but there's not. It's actually like second. When I was looking up the movies, it's quite secondary in the plot of a movie. Normally, like, there's Christmas movies, right? I think it just lasts longer. In this case, it's like one day. So when I was looking up movies, I don't know if you remember this movie, Soul Food, from back in the 90s, which I remember watching a ton of times growing up. Knives Out, The Blind Side, You've Got Mail, Spider-Man. These are all like technically Thanksgiving movies, but I think there's just like a scene.
It said Rocky was Rocky also, but I don't think of Rocky as a Thanksgiving movie.
I think there's just like a scene in a movie and Thanksgiving in it. I've never, like, I don't think we can even, like, there's no Thanksgiving movie.
Charlie Brown
technically, but I think based off a TV show, so a Thanksgiving special, but there are TV episodes. So there's a bunch of TV episodes, but even then I was like, okay, I went and looked it up.
Well, that actually segues into our first topic, but which is the difference between TV movies and TV shows, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And Friends always had Friends had Thanksgiving episodes. Obviously Friends had a special episode that Brad Pitt was on. Succession had an episode. It's the one where the whole family gets together for Thanksgiving and Logan's brother's there. And then there's a whole fight with the family. Masters of None had that. I think season two, they had a Thanksgiving episode that dived deep into like race and gender and sexuality. And I think they won an Emmy for the writing of that. But other than that, honestly, not much when it comes to Thanksgiving shows. I'll say this. We got nothing better than going into Thanksgiving than a real-life Succession episode that I was following all over the weekend. And we won't get into details here, but just fun to share watching this live go down. It was the whole OpenAI drama with Sam Altman getting kicked out and fired. And then essentially, like, there was like a coup, and then got all the support of everyone involved, from the investors and the owners and the employees. And now we're looking at, you know, what happens when over a weekend you see something like a CEO get kicked out of one of the most valuable companies in the world. And then you see the entire world join with him and then throw out the other guys. Basically a real world episode of Succession. It was fun to watch.
It's funny how, you know, we have another topic this week. Like, you know, we do say business and legal side behind the scenes, because sometimes these stories move so fast it'll make your head spin. One thing I wanted to talk about is I did go to Indo Warehouse in Brooklyn, which is a South Asian DJ EDM experience. They have culture. there's like jewelry and other crafts set up by these two DJs, Kunal Merchant, who I've met, he's a super great guy, and Kahani. And they're just like having a moment. They did their first show maybe last year at Avant Gardner, and then they sold out, blew everyone away. They played Brooklyn Mirage. This was at a venue in Brooklyn. And they've done a tour. They did an India tour. They played Amsterdam. Cool. So they're just like blowing up. And it was so great to be a part of that. I mean, being South Asian and being in the crowd and just seeing such a vibrant community and feeling kind of like, you know, it's just something I'd never experienced before. Because normally when you go to a show, it's like you're the minority, right? It was weird to have this one be like the majority. Minority kind of setting. But a lot of great talent, great event. And I'm certainly something we'll dig into in a future episode for sure.
Well, look, I mean, having a good run there, it's like South Asian DJs. And right now, as we're recording this, India is playing in the World Cup semifinals cricket against Australia. India has been the favorite to win the whole thing. And just going back to, it's funny because like some of the commentary around some of the OpenAI stuff was like, hey guys, can we get this settled? Because India is about to play Australia in the World Cup semifinals. And there's some, you know, high profile Indian people involved in this whole thing. They need to watch this match. So Pakistan, right. Bangladesh, like, my two
be,
countries.
This better be settled before the match starts.
Exactly. And Pakistan and Bangladesh, my two countries, are out. So at this point, I'm probably going to be going for India. Maybe, you know, we'll see. You got to represent the South Asian brothers at some point.
And, you know, in a past life, earlier in this life, I was a South Asian DJ. So
what was your DJ name?
Parker Hooks. So I didn't embrace the South Asian in my name, but certainly in my game.
Oh my God. Is that your line?
No, I just came up with that right now. So
Parker Hooks is very good. Parker Hooks is
it is a good. Well, so my buddy from law school, Ernie, helped me come up with it. Parker is a natural extension of Sarker, and then the hooks, you know, that's what I do is I hook people, or songs could be considered hooks.
Yeah, no, it's great.
We'll get into it.
It's great. Why don't you hook everybody up now with the with us talking about South Park?
Okay, so this is a wild story because it really does hit the essence of what I do, which is a lot of sophisticated contract and copyright licensing, in addition to, you know, other transactions. And we've talked about the streaming wars and how, in general, licenses for content most of the time are non-exclusive. But an SVOD, which is like your Netflix, your Amazon Primes, HBO Max, Paramount Plus, they often do have exclusive licenses because they view exclusive content as a way to grow subscribers. And oftentimes, so in the early days of Netflix, they would have like Marvel movies and other back catalog content. So when HBO Max was launching, they did a deal with South Park for a $500 million deal, which was exclusive for all back catalog and 30 new episodes of South Park that hadn't been released.
23 and seasons, then, right? I mean, that's the whole back catalog.
Yeah.
And then 30 the new back episodes. Catalog.
So they wanted to market themselves as like the home of South Park. Then 2 years later, MTV and Paramount, which are affiliated entities, and that's where South Park started on Comedy Central, which is a Paramount property. They did a new deal with the creator of South Park, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, in their JV for $900 million for additional exclusive content going forward, which included South Park movies. So when they announced that new deal and said that they had two movies coming out, South Park post-COVID and South Park Streaming Wars, Warner Brothers Discovery sued Paramount saying, hey, we have the exclusive rights to South Park and you're breaching that contract, and a host of other things. And just one thing for lawsuits, typically when you're a lawyer and you're a plaintiff side, you want to throw as many different causes of action into your complaint as you possibly can. If you lose on one, you want to have a backup. And we'll discuss this. We have a couple litigations in this episode. So you'll say breach of contract, tortious interference, whatever else, there's sort of a justifiable argument to make.
You're saying that you throw in a bunch in there and see which one sticks and then you focus on that one?
Well, which ones survive, right? So
survive, okay.
Let's say there's a fact pattern that happens and you were injured. Let's say you have different levels of strength to your claims. So one would be a breach of contract. Another would be a tortious interference. And basically, like, you and your legal team look at the facts and try to come up with as many credible arguments for damages, really. And then you put them all into the complaint because the other side's lawyers are going to try to defeat every single one. And if you only have one claim, then you only have one claim. But oftentimes there's multiple claims from the same fact pattern. in this case, they also alleged a breach of consumer protection laws, saying that Paramount's marketing of having those movies on Paramount Plus harmed consumers and was like deceptive marketing. And the reason we're talking about it now is because the judge dismissed that claim. And they said the claim between Warner Brothers and Paramount is not about deceiving consumers. She said consumers are sophisticated enough to know back catalog is on Warner Brothers or is on Max and that these movies are on Paramount Plus.
Right.
This isn't about deceiving consumers. This is, you know, more of a traditional breach of contract claim. And that was Paramount's argument. There's like, there's a very detailed contract, which is clear between two sophisticated parties. That's the damage here. And the judge isn't dismissing the whole case. They're just dismissing that aspect of consumer protection.
And so if I ask a question here, if the, you know, South Park Studios and Paramount are like, okay, obviously Max has all this past catalog and 30 new episodes. And so that could be in the upcoming, like, two or three seasons, right? Because let's say they do like 10 episodes per season. South Park recently, they have such weird cadence with their episodes in general. I feel like the two founders can do whatever they want, the creators. But if they were like, okay, let's, instead of releasing this as an episode in season 30, let's just release this like special episode that's more of like a lengthy, it's like 45 minutes, could be considered like a mini movie or something. That could that be considered not part of Max's part but deal, but part of Paramount's part? Like it's a TV movie, but it's
well,
only
that's the billion
minutes.
Dollar question.
Yeah.
Let's act like even the perfect contract, there's some gray area, right? And there's no such thing as a perfect contract, but you have two sophisticated parties. And the reality is you can't think of every possible issue, right? So oftentimes it's exclusive, but when you talk about back catalog, it's a lot clearer to say the episodes from the seasons listed on Exhibit A to this contract are exclusively controlled by Warner Brothers or HBO Max during the term, and they will, you know, they won't appear anywhere else. But when you talk about going forward, and so they said 30 episodes. I haven't seen the contract, but apparently, according to the complaint and the judge's decision, that didn't say that the 30 episodes had to be in a specific number of episodes per season. There was no minimum episode
right,
per season order.
Okay.
And it didn't say that a TV, like you said, something that was longer than a traditional episode. So typically episodes are like 22 minutes, maybe up to 26 minutes because there's ad breaks for streaming. There may not be ads, but I doubt it'd be 30 minutes. But even so, it could have said something like episodes shall mean any audiovisual representation of the show featuring the characters with a runtime less than 30 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
And then something that's longer than 30 minutes may not meet the definition of episode and therefore may not be exclusively within the 30. And so what Paramount's saying is these are movies and not part of your 30 order. But that's the kind of thing that is in the contractual gray area, which is why Warner Brothers felt like they had a good case and they're suing. And Paramount's defending, but it's not necessarily, I mean, it could get settled. The judge is saying there's something here, but it really depends on the exclusivity. If someone said you have the next three Avengers movies, for example, and then someone did a movie with one or two of the Avengers, but didn't call it Avengers.
Right.
And it was like, I don't know, Thor and Hulk.
Well, it's like it's Captain America Civil War, which is technically an Avengers movie because all of them are in it, but it's a Captain America movie.
Exactly. And some of this, like how you describe families and what the boundaries are, that's really gray. So unless you can, when you try to talk about exclusivity moving forward on future projects, you really have to get to like the core ingredients of what makes something a qualifying project and what the parameters are, because they're not saying that the four key characters that comprise South Park, Cartman, Kyle, Kenny, and Stan, won't appear anywhere else. They could appear in a movie, in theory, but these movies weren't theatrically released. So what makes something a TV show versus a movie?
Right.
Is it the runtime?
Right. But then there's TV movies, right? Like Hallmark has TV movies.
Right. Then there's TV movies, which is what these were, or streaming movies or whatever. But that's going to be what they decide in the case if it doesn't settle.
It's interesting because like South Park is notorious for having specials. Like they did one, you know, during COVID. They had like a COVID special. The my actual favorite South Park, it was a three-parter. I think it was a three-parter or a two-parter. It was Imagination Land. And that was like a special event. It felt more like a movie. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like part of the season. It was its own thing within a season.
Right.
And I feel like they've always just taken, like, they're like, yeah, we just want to talk about this. Let's just do it as like a weird special episode within the season, or it's a standalone thing. So I feel like that's why, because they kind of like Matt Stone and Trey Parker to just kind of do their own thing when it comes to South Park.
Well, I mean, there was South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut, which, you know.
Yes, which was the official movie back in the day.
Which was awesome, by the way. it doesn't get old for me. Although maybe there's certain, I don't know.
I had the poster in my room when I was a kid.
So that's the thing, right? It's like, what are the parameters? What makes something an episode? That's contractual. And what Paramount even said is like, we're sophisticated, they're sophisticated. Let's go by what the contract says and what the parties intended in the contract, and not some specious speculative, oh, were consumers deceived complaint or claim. And so the judge was sympathetic to that and said, yeah, I don't think this is about consumer harm. This is a breach of contract.
There you go.
We'll see. Maybe it settles. We'll come back. We'll take a quick break and talk about another case that settled so fast it'll make your head spin.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, so Paul, this case, very sad, very abrupt in its ending. This is the lawsuit against Diddy, Sean Combs by Cassie, otherwise known as Cassandra Ventura, who was known for that song, Me and You. Cassie was big in the early aughts, was founded by Diddy, and
She was discovered by Ryan Leslie.
Who was also on Bad Boy, though, right?
Yeah, so Ryan Leslie is actually like, he discovered her a couple years before she signed with Bad Boy, but she didn't release Me and You and like become a star until the Bad Boy interaction. But Ryan Leslie worked with her on her first album, and he's the guy, apparently, I saw him at a conference last year. He founded the text to marketing craze.
What do you mean text to marketing craze?
So people didn't market to people's cell phones. Like that's something he started.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I just saw an interview with him because I know that he had a Bad Boy issue as well with Diddy, but he's on his own now. And he talks very much about being independent and he doesn't need to reach millions of people. He just has like a really core group of fans that are willing to like buy tickets from him directly, merch, et cetera, et cetera. And he seems to be doing quite well. He was a super talented guy, or still is a talented guy.
Yeah, super talented, super smart. I mean, very like cerebral. And I saw him speak on how to build a brand and like a social identity. Yeah. I remember after I saw his panel, I hit you up and I was like, we need to do all these things for Better Call Paul, which we haven't necessarily done yet.
Yeah,
but that just shows it's harder. It's easier said than done.
Ryan Leslie's thing.
Ryan Leslie's thing. Yeah, okay, like building the whole funnel. You know, having six different points of contact with all your different people and narrowing it down. Anyway, so Cassie was actually discovered by Ryan Leslie, but met Diddy at a party or in that world. And she's saying he pulled her into his ostentatious, high-flying, fast-paced, drug-fueled life.
Fueled lifestyle.
Lavished her with like money and, you know, brought her into this world. But then was also very...
And she was 19. He was 37.
Yeah. So there's an 18-year difference. And basically what started as, hey, like help me launch my career. And he became presumably attracted to her and then became very controlling, abusive, sexually assaulted her. I can just list some of this off.
Yeah,
I
mean, list it was them all out. In the complaint. It's pretty terrible. Yeah.
Sexual assault, physical battery and assault, apparently like punching her in the face, kicking her. Sex trafficking, making her have sex in front of male prostitutes where he recorded it and watched. Rape in 2018, intimidation, perhaps false imprisonment. These things happening over the course of a decade and a half. Apparently in 2012, when she started getting romantically involved with Kid Cudi, he said he would murder him or something, and his car did blow up in his driveway.
Oh my God, that was Kid Cudi's car?
Yeah, it was Kid Cudi's car.
So when I was doing my research, I read that, and it was like, Diddy blows up car of someone who is romantically involved with Cassie, and I didn't realize it was Kid Cudi.
Yeah, well, and so Kid Cudi actually, in the day after this complaint, or the day the complaint was filed, said everything in there is true. Apparently, when... You know, he would beat her. And this is all in the complaint. So we're not saying any of this happened. And it's not going to be decided by a judge because we'll get into that. But she said he would beat her and not let her see anyone and just like put her in a hotel room to recover for like, you know, a week or 2 weeks, fly her around the country. And it was this cycle of like spoiling her with like money and drugs and, you know, high class accommodations, and then like beating her if she disagreed with him or if she wanted something else. And, you know, she eventually got married to a personal trainer that he introduced her to, Alex Fine, I believe his name is. And, you know, she filed this lawsuit. But apparently she said, you know, she's been dealing with addiction to drugs and alcohol ever since she met him.
Yeah.
And the only time she's been sober was when she was pregnant with her kids.
Wow.
And she blames him for all these addictions.
Right.
And, you know, it sounds like it was like a living hell for about a decade and a half.
Yeah, because it started in 2007 and she said she tried to end the relationship in 2018. Combs, this is what in terms of what I read, Combs forced her into her LA home and raped her. And then since then, I guess the chatter's been, she's been demanding, I guess, some type of settlement, threatening to write a book to damage, you know, his name about the relationship that they had. And Combs kind of ignored it. In this case, Diddy ignored it. And then, of course, she came out with this lawsuit.
She came out with the lawsuit on Thursday. And the reason she came out, so just for the legal background, there's this thing called a statute of limitations. So if you're sexually assaulted and you don't bring your claim within a certain amount of time, you're not allowed to. And, you know, there's various public policy reasons behind encouraging, you know, people to file their claims early. And so, you know, you can still get evidence. You can have witnesses testify. If you wait too long, all that stuff goes away. So we have this thing called a statute of limitations. But in New York, there was a law passed called the Adult Survivors Act, which gave people, regardless of how long ago the claim occurred, it gave them a 1-year window to file their claims. That window was about to expire this week that you're listening to the podcast. And that's why she filed the claim last week or this week. So she basically had 7 days left before the clock ran out, filed the complaint, and then it was settled the next day.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, just talking like personally how I feel about this. One, absolutely terrible. I'm not surprised hearing this about, you know, someone like Diddy. He's always seemed to be somewhat of a
bad boy.
You know, narcissistic egomaniac. Yeah. Who just like, just even when you would watch like that show, The Band, and how he would treat people, sure, maybe part of his personality in terms of being on screen, but he just seemed like one of those guys, like wants to be the center of attention, will do whatever it takes to have power and money. So it's not surprising at all. If anything, I'm glad that this came out. I hope other people come out more with it. The settlement, I think, good for her in terms of hopefully she got what she wanted and put his name out there. I just hope it's one of those things that doesn't get ignored. But let's talk about what actually happened in the settlement.
Well, to be clear, I mean, people had been saying, and if you were on TikTok when the complaint came out, people were like, this was a story in the industry for years. Like people had been talking about it. I'm so glad she finally came forward and like told her story for the world to hear. In the course of filing the complaint, Diddy's lawyer, big time defense attorney Ben Braffman, said, "This is a shakedown. These are baseless allegations. And, you know, by the way, they've been asking for $30 million and we didn't want to pay. So they filed this complaint."
Yeah.
Cassie's attorney fired back and said, "Actually, they tried to pay us 8 figures not to file this." But now to hear the stuff about Russell Brand and to see this about Diddy, it's just like that movie.
Yeah. Both of them in the same movie.
Yeah. It's like maybe this is, they're just like horrible people. And we did our top 10 hip hop albums earlier this summer. I didn't include anything other than Biggie's albums because I think, you know, Diddy's probably a better business executive. That's probably what he's best at because I think as an artist, like
the songs he was on
were better without him.
Yeah.
But, you know, he has been associated with a lot of really talented people, and he can say that Bad Boy is responsible for some of the growth of hip hop, right? So you can't
Mace, Notorious B.I.G., Faith Evans. I'm trying to think who else.
Jagged Edge. 112.
Sorry. Yeah.
So you can't deny that.
Lil Kim.
Yeah. Bad Boy's a label that was like instrumental in the growth of hip hop, but he just seems like a bad dude. And
he seems like a bad dude.
He settled this case. So in litigation, which is very expensive and very time consuming, the vast majority of cases end up settling. This happens a lot because litigation is really expensive and both sides are always weighing the cost benefit of like, what's the cost of bringing this forward, of keeping fighting this, which could be 6-7 figures.
And what do I stand to gain? So Cassie was suing for money, right? Money damages. That was her goal. And she's probably deciding, like, if I go through this, maybe I have to pay my lawyer, whatever, seven figures. Maybe they're on contingency. It potentially could take years to get a decision. And if, you know, she's got an amount in her mind she's fighting for.
Sure, sure.
And if Diddy's like, hey, I'll pay you 80%. Now, the numbers weren't disclosed. And Diddy's lawyer said, this is not an admission of wrongdoing. We're just settling this amicably, which is, you know, covering the bases. It's confidential. Diddy, the reason you would settle, not saying he's guilty or there's truth to these rumors, I'm just saying logically, sure, someone in this setting would settle because they don't want this to be public. They don't want some circus where all the complaints people are testifying and there's discovery and there's this whole public drama and more people are brought into this. And then Diddy's associates are getting dragged into it through the trial and the press.
Well, do you think they learned that from like a Johnny Depp Amber Heard thing that got dragged out so long? And by the end of it, it's like, ooh, man, this has just been tainted terribly. And like all that business is out there for the world to see.
Exactly. Like it's the public, it's the risk. So even if you win the lawsuit, you may lose the PR war. And, you know, Diddy's, you know, his net worth is over $1 billion. He makes apparently $90 million a year, reportedly. And the fact that this even got out and the impact to his empire, if there was a long drawn out trial and complaint process, probably be more damaging than whatever check he's writing to Cassie. But I don't even know how it got to this point.
Well, the unfortunate reality here is, one, I'm glad that Cassie was able to put that out there, get paid, then also doesn't have to go through the like public scrutiny of just dealing with this. I'm sure it's already emotionally taxing enough.
The other thing is like when you're that powerful in an industry, the power you have to make and break people's careers and to keep them employed or not employed gives you the power to control what they say or don't say.
When we were planning on doing this, it was, okay, let's do some research on this whole thing, talk the case. And then by the time, like the next day it was over. We'll keep you posted if there's more stuff that comes out about this.
Yeah, let's take a quick break and come back with something that's actually a little bit more educational, the FCC broadband regulation. Okay, Mesh, for all the folks who said, you know, we've been doing a lot of talking about entertainment, the business side of things, the strikes. We haven't done a nitty gritty legal topic in a while. And I wanted to discuss this. The FCC enacted final rules prohibiting discrimination in the provision of broadband, which you may think, well, blah, 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 you know, FCC, it sounds like the government, but who cares? This actually could be pretty important because it's broadband and the FCC regulates communication, which really impacts every aspect of our lives, right? Like think like if you didn't have internet, how long you know, live, right? Like my internet went down for like an hour yesterday afternoon.
Well, that's what
like,
I was saying. Yeah.
It was almost Lord of the Flies. So just to give people the background, the Commerce Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, gives Congress the authority to regulate foreign and interstate commerce. So Congress has the authority to regulate commerce. In 1934, they established the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, which regulates telecom industry, radio, and wire communication in the U.S. Basically, Congress said, hey, we don't want 50 different states to have their own communication regimes. We think it's important for this to be centralized and unified across the country. Let's establish the FCC, give them the authority to regulate. And then that established this regime, Title I and Title II. Title II is common carriers, which are heavily regulated. And Title I is light touch, open regulation, information services. And I don't know if you guys remember back in 2020, there was this debate about net neutrality because the FCC was going to try to regulate broadband under Title II instead of as an information service. And all the internet companies and even the streamers were like, no, 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 we want open internet. We want light touch regulation. We don't want to be regulated heavily. And the reason we're talking about this now is because the Republicans favoring less regulation think that the FCC is trying to get back to regulating broadband heavily with this rulemaking. So what they said, and this is all part of Biden's infrastructure law in 2021, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act said, when that was passed in 2021, they said by November 15th, 2023, the FCC needs to implement rules to regulate, to prevent the discrimination of broadband access in the U.S. So the FCC implemented those rules last week.
So what they mean by that is prevent digital discrimination of broadband access based on income level, race, ethnicity, color, religion, national origin. And so are they saying that in relation to some people in some areas just get better internet access and pricing than others? Is that what it comes down to?
Well, that's the analysis, right? So you want to read those again?
Yeah. So it's the FCC is implementing the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which directed the commission to prevent digital discrimination of broadband access based on income level, race, ethnicity, color, religion, or national origin.
Right. So those are considered protected classes. Those are not necessarily income level, but discrimination on any of those bases is something that is, you know, the government says we want equal access. So if you are of one ethnicity or one color or one religion or one national origin, you shouldn't have, you know, worse broadband access or less broadband access, same with income level or race, right? So equality of access to broadband is an important national objective and virtue. And the FCC's job is to ensure that Americans have access regardless of any of those characteristics, right? Color, religion, national origin, ethnicity, race, income level. And so what the FCC is saying is they just passed the rule to say whether or not we don't have to prove intent. So if a broadband company, if their policies, business policies, rules, provision of broadband has a disparate impact on any one of these bases, whether it's income level, national origin, ethnicity, color, religion, race, that's something that is actionable. They can look into it and they can fine the companies for policies that have impacts that are disparate. And what the Republicans are saying is it shouldn't be enough to prove a disparate impact. You also have to prove discriminatory intent, meaning some broadband company is saying, well, I don't want people that have purple skin or green skin to have broadband. So I'm going to find all the neighborhoods where people of that skin color live, and I'm not going to put broadband in those neighborhoods. What the Republicans are saying, you have to prove an intent to discriminate. So you have to find some sort of internal correspondence or memo that says we're targeting these people, or we're avoiding these areas, and we're only putting broadband in these areas where it's profitable for us or where blah, blah, blah. Right. And what the FCC is saying is, even though we haven't seen evidence of discriminatory intent, we're not saying we necessarily need to see that, because intent is sort of secondary here. What we need to see is impact. So they're basically making the bar to making a complaint a lot lower by saying it's a disparate impact as opposed to having to prove intent. And they're going to create this new portal for consumer complaints. So if you live in a rural area and you're like, you know, I've been calling, you know, broadband company X and I can't get access, I have to just use dial up or whatever because I don't have broadband, then they can file a complaint. And if there's enough of those complaints, the FCC is going to meet monthly to look at the trends in the complaints. They can start investigating and fining broadband companies.
Yeah, this is interesting, because then if you're a broadband company and you're looking at a certain area, let's say you have made some analysis that the amount of infrastructure spend to put broadband here versus what we would get paid back, then they decide not to do it for whatever reason. Probably because, again, like income levels, whatever it might be. But it is interesting that, you know, this is kind of a reason why, a little side note, that I think people talk about Starlink, which is SpaceX satellite internet, essentially, that covers area like rural areas or areas where like
without internet the build is not out, accessible. Right? Once without they have the a satellite out, yeah. network, you don't need to lay the cable, which is a lot cheaper.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, so to your point, the FCC did say in response to these complaints, the broadband providers are allowed to provide a legitimate business justification for why they're not providing broadband in a certain area. So, for example, if there's a low-income community and it's on the other side of a mountain, and you know the broadband company says, for us to put broadband on that side of the mountain, we'd have to blow up XYZ or go through some sort of protected wildlife refuge. That's a legitimate business reason not to have broadband there. So that's a response. So they just need to provide a response. But it's a much lower standard if you don't have to prove intent. And the Republican concern is that when you say, equal access on something like income level, that is a small step from rate regulation. And what they don't want the FCC to be able to do is say, you're charging too much for broadband.
Too much.
And establish a pricing structure, because it's very important to the Republicans. And I think overall, the justification is that free market is going to lead to the best broadband pricing. And if companies can charge freely what the market's willing to pay, then they're going to spend more in investing in infrastructure and building out the product.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that only really happens in like high density areas. You know, I had big TV provider and internet that was charging me an arm and a leg. And then company B comes around, offers something in the elevator. I'm seeing like a poster that just says high speed internet, $30. My neighbor got it. He's like, yeah, it's pretty easy to set up. Like it's like no background checks, no big long contracts. I immediately switched to it. I'm now paying $30 a month for, you know, 250 megabyte per second download speed or whatever it might be. I'm pretty happy with it and I don't have to deal with the big company, but that's in New York City. That's not going to happen in like
to your
random
point,
town, middle America.
I used to have company B in my previous apartment. Since I moved in 2021, I no longer have access to company B. I only have to use company A. On the FCC's rulemaking, I could file a complaint and say company B won't come to my area because of XYZ reason. And maybe the company B that is so great, maybe they would have to come to my area, or maybe they'd have. So that's the thinking. It's like, it is business motivated in the sense that company B is a great company. They provide great service for a lower rate, but they can't build out a network that covers every square foot of New York City. That just takes time, right? Maybe they'll get here eventually. But to your point, in smaller areas where it's like people are very spread out, it's just going to take time and money. And are they going to build a huge infrastructure to service, you know, 1,000 people? I don't know.
Yeah. And I would make the argument to kind of conclude on this. My personal opinion is if you think about the country as a whole and you want the country to progress over, like, say, the next several decades and be competitive, everyone in the country should have access to internet. We could get into the whole thing. They should also have access to healthcare. But in this case, access to internet, the ability to use what everyone has, you know, this right to have, like access to internet, access to information, what potentially that can get you. That should be everyone in the country. That only makes people potentially more competitive, better, et cetera.
No one's disagreeing with what you're saying as far as it should be widespread access is critical. What the disagreement is, do you have to prove that companies were intending to discriminate, or do you just have to prove that the impact was discriminatory? That's really the crux of it. Because proving the intent is a lot harder thing to prove.
Yeah, and like I guess when you think about it from a business standpoint, when you're doing a market analysis on like your customer and your target audience, like you are looking at things like, do they have the ability to pay? I mean, this happens all the time when people are thinking about like millennials versus Gen Z versus Gen A. Who is a higher spender? When they're looking at like the age, right? You're now focused on millennials. At one point, you were focused on like Gen Xers. Millennials have higher spend than Gen Z. Gen Z soon will have higher spend and et cetera, et cetera. And then you adjust based on that.
Right. But in, you know, the companies in their, you know, like goals, they want to sell their product to as many purchasers as possible, right? So if a market becomes saturated, they're going to look for markets where they're less saturated. In theory, you know, if you have a free market, everyone eventually will get internet access. But this is the sort of thing like, you know, people should have the right to file a complaint if they feel like they can't get access and they've tried contacting companies and they just can't get access.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Yeah.
Maybe a satellite answer is the answer.
Yeah. Well, I like this topic. I think good choice on picking it, Paul. At first, when you picked it, when the way it sounds, I was like, oh, man, this is going to be super dense. But it's pretty applicable to everyone.
Everyone needs internet, you know, at this point.
Yeah. Well, always a pleasure hearing the breakdowns. Folks, we all hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and that's our show for this week. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast, Apple, Spotify, wherever you choose to listen. Tell your friends, tell your family. Subscribe to us at Better Call Paul, the podcast.
Maybe play
TikTok,
the show
Instagram.
For Thanksgiving. Maybe just play it for all your friends and family.
When your family's hanging out before the dinner, before grace, just play an episode. And I think, you know, you should be rewarded. Better Call Paul is produced and edited by Valentino Rivera and assistant producer Lisa Sanders. Have a great week.
Thanks, everyone.